My name is Chris Deasy, and it was so good to record my first face-to-face interview since lockdown was eased. And my guest this week is the Reverend Dr. Justin Lewis Anthony, Rector of Chingford. Justin was one of my PhD students a few years ago, and he talks about how he ended up doing a PhD. He explains what his motivations were. The topic of leadership was something that made him angry. He talks about how cinema is the functioning mythological delivery system of the 20th century. And he talks about how people often expect church leaders to function like John Wayne. Justin would rather teach people to be disciples. We discuss Bonhoeffer and Terry Pratchett and Jesus films and what counts as a historical fact. And he talks about being taught by David Starkey. Now, nostalgia is one of the processes whereby we apply meaning to things that have happened. We learn why Justin is suspicious about authenticity. And he talks about Little House on the Prairie. We learn why he's bored by dark superheroes and the problem with thinking of authenticity as an empirical standard and why it's not a goal for human flourishing. We look at Robin Hood and Led Zeppelin and Dirty Dancing, Naked Gun 33 and a Third, Rocky Horror, and the relationship between nostalgia and reception theory. We talk about the problems of film and theology and operating within a canon. And we move on to talk about escapism and Richard Curtis, and we talk about what we are escaping to that's crucial to escapism. We talk about its consumer delivery mechanism basis in films. Now, Justin is not crippled by memories of the past, and he talks about having a sensitivity to one's surroundings and history in the context of having a Welsh father. He talks about disasters survived, and recognising one's responsibilities to others rather than introspection, which we apply to COVID. He tells us why Flatliners is a film he walked out of due to the idea that we can manipulate death. He talks about what it is that justifies his existence and the danger of living one's life through one's children. We also discuss the importance of history and why there may not be much point in worrying about the future. It was so wonderful in Chingford to catch up one Saturday afternoon with Justin Lewis Anthony for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is an absolute pleasure to have Dr., the Reverend Dr. Justin Lewis Anthony, who is the Rector at Chingford.
Rector of Chingford.
Yeah, and of course we knew each other in a previous incarnation, for you anyway, at the University of Kent, which must have been, what, 12, 13 years ago that we first met?
I think it was about the year after you arrived, so 2007?
Yeah, I remember, I came there 2004, and you did a PhD with me.
So, I did a PhD with me. You were up so I was Rector of Hackington in Canterbury, which includes the University of Kent in the parish. I was spending a lot of time thinking about a subject area which ended up being my PhD, and I thought, if I'm sitting in the university library, in the Templeman Library, I may as well actually have somebody supervising my reading. And I'm in the parish, visiting the stacks, I suppose that counts. And I had come across your book when I was still in Oxford on Scorsese and Redemption. And it was the area that I was interested in, so everything worked together for the good.
Yeah. And I remember, because I sadly missed your graduation ceremony, but I think you said that you broke all precedents because you had a round of applause when the title of your PhD was read out to the assembled congregation.
It wasn't a round of applause, it was more risible laughter. But as I also graduated with the... I honestly can't work out why this is, but there was... The University of Kent graduation that year had somebody from the London Clown School graduating, and somebody graduated with an applied master's in clowning and went up to get his degree wearing clown shoes. And I thought, well, I'm in good company here. So.
Well, they did that. So I went to one of the November ceremonies, maybe the year afterwards, and you're right. And not only do they get something like, as you say, a degree in clown studies, but of course they dress the part. So they'd be wearing the full regalia, but with, you know, Mickey Mouse shoes.
And to be perfectly honest, the University of Kent PhD robes are pretty close to it as well.
But so, and you did, I always think, although as your supervisor, I probably should speak this with more authority, but leadership and mythology, which was actually, I think, at the time, we used to have some wonderful conversations around, because you, whatever you were writing always seemed to resonate with, well, whatever was in the news at the time and whatever was happening in government. And of course, the question of leadership always seemed to rebound in terms of the daily news cycle. But you seem to be doing something that was really cutting edge, but very topical. And I don't know if you found when you were doing it that you had no shortage of material, or whether you needed to just cut all that out and just focus on the core readings, because it was such a lively area to be following.
Well, I mean, I was an unexpected PhD student and a mature student, or rather elderly, if not necessarily mature. And the reason why I did that as a PhD was that it was something that really irritated me. And I've said this to students I've supervised subsequently. If you're looking for a subject for a dissertation, because you're going to be dealing with it for so many years, you're going to get so bored and sick and tired of it, then at least make it something that you're really angry about. And the whole way in which leadership was being presented as the universal solution to every ill, without anybody ever clearly defining what leadership was something that really irritated me, particularly coming from working within the church, because the Church of England always introduces as the new saving technique the thing that's been rejected by secular society 30 years before. So managerialism and leadership and all that kind of stuff comes into the church after IBM has moved on to something else. And so I was being subjected to it from my professional point of view, and I was very suspicious of its provenance. So yeah, you were right. I mean, there was a lot of material that I was going to look at and ended cutting out. Mm. And the reason why I got you as my supervisor was because I saw that ultimately the source of all thinking about what leadership is in our society isn't theoretical. It isn't from business studies. It isn't from even from psychology. It's from functioning mythology. And cinema is the functioning mythological delivery system of the 20th and 21st century. And you could see over and over and over again when people would talk about what they thought of as a good leader, or what they thought as good leadership skills, they were referring back to tropes that they had seen in cinema. So if we could interrogate what cinema was portraying, then we could understand what it was that that people were thinking should apply for the world. And this is especially true when it comes to the church and the church talking about leadership. You know, people think that they're following Jesus. They'd be happy to have the example of Pope Francis. They still mean John Wayne. And they expect, you know, they expect the Archbishop of Canterbury to function like John Wayne. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I've just recently moved house, and I've got all my notes, all my photocopies, all those ring binder files, because I think I was the last generation who actually printed out photocopies. And there are four or five unexamined areas which I just never got incorporated into the PhD, and thank God for that, because it's 120,000 words already.
Mm. Did you find when you were writing it, though, that you mentioned John Wayne, was there that sense in which the church can teach the movies something, or the movies can teach the church something? Because is it the sense that there is an ideal leader, or an ideal leader in mythology rather than in actuality, or is there a kind of a benchmark or a blueprint for a leader that is there but hasn't yet been discovered? Do you feel that through writing your thesis you've sort of found the appropriate right kind of leader in either the church or in the movies who we can perhaps look to during these, particularly, not least as this is the first interview since lockdown, to these very sort of dark times where we're crying out for leadership but arguably don't seem to be getting it?
Okay, this is why my career in the church has been so singularly unsuccessful in the last 10 years, is because I don't think that the Christian church has got anything, should have anything to do with the leader. When the Christian church is looking for a leader, what they're doing is that they're incorporating something that has been wholly compromised by power, domination, and oppression. This is why the reason I put this to people, this is why leadership studies is not a big thing in Germany, because leadership studies in Germany is about the Führer Prinzip and the leadership principle. And Germany's got a bit of a downer on the idea of studying what it means to be a Führer. It's like when I went to theological college in the end of the 80s, the buzzword was collaborative ministry. All ministry had to be collaborative. You can't have the parish priest saying what goes. You have to engage in collaboration with the laity. And this applied to the whole of the Church of England, except for one bit of the Diocese of Winchester, which was the Channel Islands, because the Channel Islands had a very different idea of what constituted collaboration. And their experience during the Second World War meant that they really didn't want to talk about that. So for when it comes, I keep on resisting the idea of, no, really what we have to do is fine-tune our idea of the perfect leader. For me, the key for it, for the church, is to understand what it means to be a disciple. We don't need to find a leader. We've got a leader. That's Jesus. Everybody else who inserts themselves in the role of leadership is actually inserting themselves in the role of the Messiah or the Saviour. What it means to be a member of the church and what it means to be part of the body of Christ is to be a disciple. You know, this idea that a school that you and I know not very far away from the University of Kent, their mission was to turn out leaders, all 1,200 of them, every single one a leader. I'm thinking, well, who are going to be the followers of all these leaders? So my mission in the church, which is a hugely unpopular one, is to teach people how to be disciples. And I completely understand the paradox and the irony of my situation, which is telling people to not to look for leaders.
And I found actually your research helped me in a module I was teaching. It was on the death of God. We were looking at Bonhoeffer and that whole sense of the anti-leader, or the person who is the leader through weakness and humility.
Yeah.
And the paradox in that. And then applying it with the students. There would always be some presidential election or some by-election or some particular event that we were all following on the news, and sort of saying, well, how would you relate, who would you vote for in the particular context of, do you want somebody to tell you what to do? Do you want somebody to set an example? Is an ideal leader somebody you can sit and imagine having a pint with in the pub? Or do you need somebody to be aloof and distant and omnipotent? And I think that the debate was very interesting, because there's the classic assumptions of, you mentioned John Wayne, which is the very kind of authoritarian or the very strong, knows his own mind leader, or you want somebody who is one of us. And the theological implications of that are obvious, but also at the same time, a bit strange.
So, well, Rowan Williams said something really interesting about this, because the expectations that were placed upon him as Archbishop of Canterbury, and therefore primus inter pares in the Anglican Communion, was to be a leader. And I saw him in conversation with Ian Hislop in Canterbury Cathedral once, and talking about this expectation of being a leader. And Rowan said that when people say what they want leadership in the church, what they very often mean is they want somebody to tell them to stop doing what it is that they're doing. Nobody wants to be told themselves, what I need is I need to be bullied into behaving better. No, what I need is for you to bully them into behaving better. So leadership is always something that other people need rather than ourselves. Now, Bonhoeffer is a very, very good example, because I spent quite a bit of time dealing with Bonhoeffer, and up there on the shelves there, I've got all of his the English edition of his works, which is furnishes a room beautifully. Bonhoeffer came out of a culture which was desperate for a leader from the 1890s onwards. I mean, even from the 1870s onwards with German reunification, was that there was this yearning for the Führer. Hitler wasn't the only person who was referred to as the Führer. He just ended up being on the top of the heap until the whole of Germany did become a heap under his leadership. So Bonhoeffer came out of a culture which was yearning for a leader, and Bonhoeffer himself would have made a fantastic candidate for it. He was 6 foot whatever, he was blonde hair, blue-eyed, extremely skillful, played Bach like an angel, played tennis like, I was going to say Tim Henman, but played tennis more like Roger Federer, and was completely charismatic, and yet completely refused that role, stepped away from it, stepped aside from it. And the way that he worked this out in very practical terms in his when he was the leader of the illegal seminary in Finkenwalde shows that, you know, he was somebody who was constantly tempted, constantly pushed, constantly expected to provide the stern, authoritarian, follow me, Kameraden, and refused to do that because he recognized that his greatest role in life was to be a disciple and to teach others how to be a disciple. So the another good example of this slightly pathetic one is Corporal Carrot in Terry Pratchett's Discworld books, especially the books about the City Watch in Ankh-Morpork. Corporal Carrot comes as a mysterious figure into the City Watch, laden down with all the signs and symbols of being the unrecognized king of the city. He has a mysterious sword. He's 6'5". He's incredibly charismatic. Everybody knows about him. But Carrot absolutely refuses to be the once and future king. And Pratchett is playing with the imagery of the once and future king from T.H. White and from Mort d'Arthur and all this kind of stuff. But Carrot himself has all the qualities to be the leader, but recognizes that in the anarchic world of Ankh-Morpork, the only way that you can possibly have a leader is somebody who is prepared to use violence all the time as an instrument of government. And in Pratchett's moral universe, that's completely unacceptable.
And there is that notion of counterpoint, the idea that, as you say, we're looking for leaders, but it's also whoever is doing the leading also, by definition, you know, has to have people who are willing to be or able to be followed. Mm-hmm. And I think in the Jesus epics, the biblical epics, is fascinating the way in which Jesus speaks, they listen. It's like Karl Barth, God speaks, man listens. If you watch King of Kings, Jesus is very charismatic, but everybody is listening in silence, or it's even worse, in The Greatest Story Ever Told. And of course, that is an inauthentic display of both leadership and followership, if you like, a discipleship, because it's the idea that people just go along, which is what you're talking about in the case of Hitler and Germany, the idea that people are so desperate for a leader that they will suck up without critique whatever it is that they're hearing. And I think that it's funny how in the later, you think of Scorsese's Last Temptation, you then have the leader, inverted commas, and I say inverted commas because obviously this is a leader with neurotic sort of tendencies, but who is also channeling and thinking through the nature of his calling. And then you have the followers who are also saying, well, hang on, why do we want to be led by you? And of course, there's a process of critical self-reflection on both sides. And I'd never seen anything quite like that before. When I first saw Last Temptation, I didn't know what to make of it because there was no obvious template for it. It broke the mould in terms of what we expect from those reverential biopics.
So what we've got, I mean, in depictions of Jesus's leadership, heavy use of inverted commas around that word, in the Jesus movies, is then coming to terms with the contradictions or the complementarian part of the scriptural record. So on the one hand, you have Jesus who is wholly charismatic, and who, as soon as people meet him, or as soon as people encounter him physically or emotionally, they recognize his true nature and are prepared to give up everything in order to follow him. So, you know, the calling of the disciples in that way. Or Jesus' healing miracles, you know, just touching the hem of his garment and I shall be made clean. You know, the best example, which is probably slightly a singular situation, is Thomas's encounter with the risen Christ. Thomas demands proof. He sets out what his criteria for proof would be ahead of time. And then when he encounters the risen Christ, he does not go through with that, putting his hands into Jesus' wounds, and responds, "My Lord and my God." So there's a classic case of sort of Weber's charismatic leader. And yet at the same time, you have Jesus being unable to do any works of power in Nazareth. You have Jesus not being recognized as being who he really is. You have the tropes coming back from the Hebrew scriptures of, does it mean nothing to you, all ye who pass by? That Jesus' ministry was hidden and unseen. And you know, the idea that we have to get around was that Jesus' crucifixion was just another crucifixion. It wasn't the Passion of the Christ, where the whole world came to a stop. You know, the descriptions in the Gospels of of the pathetic fallacy functioning was designed to underline a spiritual truth that was seen subsequently. I mean, how many crucifixions were there in the week before Jesus' own crucifixion? It was a common or day thing. And that's why, so you see, in the scriptural paintings of Netherlandish painters, the number of crucifixions where you will have Jesus's crucifixion happening in the context of a great landscape painting high up on a hill in miniature, and all the crowds walking past and not seeing what's going on. So there's this dialogue that's happening actually within scripture itself, that of course once you encounter Jesus then you absolutely know who he is and there is no choice in the matter, and yet at the same time he is the man of constant sorrows and is unrecognized. And I think one of the distortions that we get in our cultural depictions of Jesus is deciding on one or the other of those things rather than holding them in dialogue and tension.
And I think also in terms of nostalgia, you have this question, looking back, how easy, through rose-coloured spectacles, something that at the time may have seemed very ordinary or commonplace subsequently takes on a whole new connotation. And then, of course, we're reading back into the past something that may not have happened. So would you want to go back to the past and find out that that shattered, or do we like to live in a mythologized past? Can you apply? I mean,
no, I wouldn't say that we go back into the past and see things that didn't happen. I mean, my first degree was in history, and of course it was back in the days when you had to read Carr's What Is History as preparation for it. And you know, the question is, what counts as history? What counts as a historical fact? Well, there's no end of data from the past that you can choose from the past. But whether it's significant is another question. And, you know, how many times did Julius Caesar cross the Rubicon? Well, he had to do it an awful lot of times to get to and from Transalpine Gaul, to cross that particular river. Yet Caesar crossing the Rubicon is one significant historical event. One of the best teachers that I had when I was doing my first degree, which seems like a strange thing to admit now, is David Starkey, who is the second best teacher that I've ever had, third best teacher, present company included, that I ever had. And David Starkey made the point that there was a, I think it was sometime during the Wars of the Roses, that there was a skirmish in Hoddesdon, not very far away from where we are now, in Hertfordshire, a skirmish between two bands of mercenaries, which was noted in a chronicle and pretty much forgotten about until somebody wrote a monograph about why this skirmish led to this situation, led to this situation, led to this situation. Therefore, the Battle of Hoddesdon becomes a significant moment in history. You know, the skirmish always happened, but it became a moment in history in the way that we tell our story and understand who we are. So I think that, you know, for nostalgia, yes, nostalgia, you know, looking back to what might have been or what could have been or what should have been is one of the processes by which we apply meaning to things that have happened. So, you know, when it comes to when it comes to the Gospels, collect up all of, get an old-fashioned Bible, all the red letter passages of the Bible, the words that Jesus spoke himself. Read those out. It will take you, in all four Gospels, it will take you 40 minutes to read out all the words of Jesus. His personal ministry was 1, 2, or 3 years long. He didn't say the same. He wasn't Elton John. He wasn't playing the same songs over and over again. He must have said different stuff all that time. But we have taken this distilled, collected, and made these things the significant things. Jesus' Sermon on the Mount was probably a compilation, but now we've turned it into the skirmish of Hoddesdon.
And what about the quest for, well, authenticity, the sense of the right words, the actual words? I mean, the Coen brothers, brilliantly in the case of Fargo, said this is based on actual events. Of course it wasn't, yeah. But of course I remember the Johnny Cash biopic Walk the Line, and of course obviously when you're dealing with people who are still alive, or you know, Cash's family, you have to make sure that if you're doing a biopic of people who are still alive that you don't offend anybody, that you're not going to be sued. But I remember feeling that there was something about that that felt hollow. I know Johnny Cash's sister were saying, oh, he was a good holy man, he was a man of God. And I thought, well, the whole point of Johnny Cash is that he seemed to be somebody who was literally walking the line, or sometimes falling across or off the line. And I just thought that, you know, a lot of Cash's appeal is that he's a bit of an iconoclast. What I thought was very interesting is the way that different people are going to sort of read into somebody's life what they want to present, what they want to get out of it. And I just wonder whether, certainly when we're talking about nostalgia or this sort of quest for authenticity about what did somebody actually say, you know, you're never going to get to the heart of that. And does it really matter? I suppose in more contemporary times these days, it is more possible to get people's actual words because they're recorded or they're published. And in a sense, there's multiple versions of those. They can be corroborated. But to what extent does it matter whether we've got, you know, what is the importance? What is the role of authenticity? Is there a sense that faith, you know, it came up in the case of the Passion of the Christ, didn't it? That the Pope on his deathbed supposedly saw it and said, it is as it was. And then, of course, Gibson's movie machine went to town on that and said, therefore, the Pope is saying that it is, that, you know, this film has authenticity. Mm. And yet, of course, the film, if that does have authenticity, raises all sorts of questions about violence and anti-Semitism, etc. So what role is authenticity in nostalgia and in the way we apprehend the past?
Well, I mean, we've been talking a bit about this already today, yeah, about the function of authenticity. I'm very suspicious of authenticity. I'm especially suspicious of the way that authenticity has been valorized in our contemporary society. And I think it's because we recognize that somehow our society is fake and ersatz. So therefore, we're looking for something that's genuine, industrial, if necessary, post-industrial. I mean, for goodness sake, there's a fashion shop who decorates its stores with old sewing machines as if somehow this makes it more authentic.
Oh, is this All Saints?
I have no idea, yeah. Chris, but I you know...
Where do you think my jacket came from?
I recognise your greater reading of Vogue. But, you know, so there you go. That we package up our past and we sell it back to ourselves as a way of making it authentic. I came across a really good example of why we should be suspicious of proclamations of authenticity in the Jewett and whatever it is book.
Supernatural Redeemer, yeah.
Yeah. So they were talking about that and about the question of authenticity in there, and they quoted a filmmaker who was talking about the TV movie that he was making, which had just been subject to the most extensive historical research that had ever been undertaken. And this was going to be the most authentic, the most real depiction of what life was like on the American frontier for pioneers. And this was, you know, this was how it was going to be lived. And the person being interviewed was Michael Landon, and he was talking about Little House on the Prairie. And if anybody can remember Little House on the Prairie and the TV program and how it contrasts with the original books, you realize it's not at all authentic. The whole damn thing was filmed in California. And you know, those of us who watch American TV from the 60s and the 70s don't realize that America has got a varied landscape, which doesn't all look like the canyons of California. I mean, every planet that Star Trek ever beamed down to is exactly the same countryside that you get in Little House on the Prairie. So this idea that, you know, here was a man who really truly thought that he was making an authentic program. Actually, what he was doing was he was reflecting the times and culture of his time. This is why I'm so bored of dark superheroes. This is why I'm so bored of TV detectives who have who operate outside the law and who are in rebellion against their organisation and who have an unhappy home life. I mean, it would just be really, really interesting one day to see a TV detective who does it by the book and goes home to his loving wife and children. Because that would be strange and unusual. Yeah. So, you know, your question of authenticity is very much, it's staring down the bottom of the well. And seeing ourselves staring back. What is it that we're looking for in our time and our day? And how can we confirm the choices that we've made in our society by saying, you know, how it was in those olden days, they were just like us. So we end up with the ridiculous situation of the Romans being 21st century people, But in fancy dress. I caught a glimpse the other night of Harlots on TV. And it was on TV for about 30 seconds before I turned it off. And I thought, okay, this is basically EastEnders but with busts. Mm. All that they've done is they've taken the relationships that we see in EastEnders now, mm. and they've put it into 18th century costume.
Yeah.
And somehow that this is an authentic way of depicting the way in which men and women, or women of negotiable virtue, functioned in 18th century London. Mm. Authenticity is more says about our own psychological needs than it does about the reality of the past.
I posted a review of the Robin Hood Prince of Tides a few months ago, and of course everyone was like, oh, it's so ridiculous, because he arrives in England and you see the port Prince of Dover behind it.
Robin Hood, Prince of Tides, that would be a mashup.
No, that would be Barbara Streisand, I think, was cruelly overlooked for the role. Although I did probably see them in the same week. I hadn't thought of that. Since both 91. But what is interesting, we were looking for princes in 91, that was the leadership we were missing. But what was really funny is that he arrives at the port of Dover, and then a moment later he says, I can see Nottingham Castle in front. I think it was 2 years, about 2018, I saw the latest Robin Hood movie. I didn't see the Russell Crowe one, but I saw the one which has F. Murray Abraham incongruously appearing at one. Jamie Foxx, I think, plays one of the lead roles. And in that, it's so obviously a sort of like, it's Hollyoaks, it's Robin Hood, it's not even pretending. I mean, they're all sort of wearing leather jackets, and it's all sort of like meant to be, when, you know, whichever century it's set in, but kind of with a very obvious twist. It's something mm-hmm. straight out of modern soap operas. And I gave it a very sort of disparaging review, but also at the time I thought, but is that any different to anything else we've ever watched? Yes, which says something about the moors and the climate at the time. So I thought, I can't criticise it. I can say it, maybe it's badly acted, or I can say that it perhaps is too simplistic, but actually it's doing what it's doing to the source material is no. I mean, Guy Ritchie is actually really adept at this, because I couldn't believe it when he did the one of the Disney films, Aladdin, a couple of years ago. But also, I thought, well, you know, all of his films in that sense are all about revisionism, and actually, he has his finger on the pulse. Mm-hmm. He's not pretending that he's making something that would have been made in the 13th century or whenever. He's very clear that it was made in the 90s or the 2000s or whenever it was. And actually, there's more, if you like, authenticity in that than trying to replicate the past.
Well, the problem is that we think that authenticity is some kind of empirical standard, yeah. rather than it just being a moving thing that is the mirror that we move along with ourselves. Yeah. You know, I mean, the past is another country. They do things differently there. We don't like to think that. We like to think they're us, and they're just wearing silly clothes. And, you know, that's my objection to authenticity. Particularly when it comes to authenticity as a, you know, when we move it from a movie to the personal issues, that authenticity is something that we should seek for ourselves. And the first book I wrote, talking about a Bosch painting in the National Gallery, talking about a psychological interpretation of this particular painting, and it's the Passion of the Christ and Jesus being tortured before his crucifixion. And in a way, the four persecutors of Christ are being truly authentic to themselves. The two representatives of the imperial powers of the time are being truly authentic. That's what they want to do. You know, I'm bashing you over the head because I want to bash you over the head. But authenticity is not in itself a goal for human flourishing. So I'm suspicious of when authenticity is applied to cultural artifacts, because far more often than not, it just reflects the values and the mores of the time, and very, very uncritically.
Yeah, and I always find it interesting that, certainly in lockdown, because I couldn't see any new films, I was going back in super spanking Blu-ray, and I did finally succumb to Amazon Prime, in amazing digital format, high definition, the films that I saw first time around, often and pan and scan VHS in the 90s, but watching the same films, but almost closer to source, it felt, than the films even would have been seen at the time. And I wonder what that was saying. It's almost as though there was a set source, if you like, almost, not quite scripture, but something that is very, almost authoritative to me, because it represents my university years, for example. And it's as though I need to have, albeit in different formats, access to something foundational that the technology can move, and I'll move with it. But there's something about the source material that has to remain, in some sense, static.
The authenticity that you're looking for is your sense of who you were when you first saw it.
Of course.
And I'll give you an example from my own experience. So one of the first films that my father took me to go and see, when, you know, I'm born and raised in Singapore, child of the British Empire, and my father took me to the Sampan cinema in Singapore to go and see The Battle of Britain when it came out in 1969. And my father always told the story, I can't remember it, that he was very, very proud of me, where two Singaporean Chinese guys in the row behind us said, is that a Messerschmitt? And I turned around age four and said, no, it's a Stuka. And so my father was very pleased that he'd brainwashed me in that way. But the thing I can remember from seeing the film the first time, aged four, in this cinema, was one bit where a gunner in a Heinkel bomber gets hit by machine gun bullets and his goggles fill up with blood. And being amazed by how gory that was. Now, one of my guilty pleasures for lockdown was I bought a Blu-ray of The Battle of Britain. And here's a digitally remastered 4K whatever, projected so much better than it would have been on 35mm in a tropical cinema. And yet it was nothing like as powerful as the first time I saw it. Nothing like as gory. And it's part of the, it's like the discussion about how much blood do you see in the shower scene in Psycho? The way we remember it is it's so much blood. And yet you never see it in the original film. So the nostalgia is for the first impression, the first time we hear it. Another example, Led Zeppelin. If you listen to any live Led Zeppelin, it's almost impossible to hear the first minute and a half of a performance of Stairway to Heaven, because everybody knows that opening arpeggio and everybody's waiting for that opening arpeggio, and everybody wants to show that they recognise that opening arpeggio by clapping. Except there's a BBC CDs of Led Zeppelin live at the BBC, and they did a live concert at the Radio Theatre, introduced by John Peel, and they're playing some of their new tracks, man. And one of them is the first ever live performance of Stairway to Heaven. And the really bizarre thing about it is you hear the opening arpeggio with no reaction at all, because nobody knows what it is that they're about to hear. Once people have heard it, there's no way of going back to hearing. How do you hear Bridge Over Troubled Water for the first time? Again, you can't. And every time that we hear it, there's a part of us which is listening to Bridge Over Troubled Water or any great powerful piece of music like that. There's a part of us which is hearing the music, but it's also hearing the memory of us hearing the music. And that's a really difficult thing to separate ourselves from.
I had it from the opposite side. I'm afraid my example is going to be a little less sublime. It's actually a Dirty Dancing. I saw the musical. I went along. It was a trip. I reluctantly went along. I'd never seen the film, and it was the musical. I thought, what is the fuss all about? So I went along, not having seen the film, not really knowing the dialogue. And you know the bit where nobody puts baby in the corner.
Everybody,
you don't know. Okay, well, lucky you. And everybody then was sort of like laughing along. And I thought, what? I don't get this. So of course, I subsequently saw the film and got it. And everyone talks about it. I saw the film at the cinema last week, because of course now that they're not showing any, there are no new films coming out at the moment. And I thought, let's see what all the fuss is about. Loads of people I know.
Is this the first time you'd ever seen the film?
No, maybe only the second actually. Bizarrely, okay. I've got some blind spots, but yeah. But I saw it, and I was waiting for that moment when everyone. There weren't that many in the auditorium, but I thought enough to. But it was in silence. But so I'd seen, it's like a Christopher Nolan movie, but sort of like I saw the film or saw the play version or the stage version of the film first when it already entered cultural mythology, and then when I saw it, almost like going back to source the second time around. It fell on deaf ears, and I thought, I've done everything back to front. In so much of my life, I've done that. But I thought that was very interesting, that I sort of got a flavour of the impact of the film when it was turned into a musical, before the film itself. And so it made me just reflect in a very kind of self-referential way, I guess, as to what it is that makes, because it in itself, I don't think at the time when the film was made, I think it was probably ironically people were laughing at it, because I don't think it was sort of done in a sort of Alan Partridge type, the joke, the people making the film are in on it. I think it just entered folklore because it's just such a stupid line to say, and he says it so seriously. Mm. But that was very interesting, but it made me revisit all of that and say, well, actually, it's just a very sort of like really silly line that people are then subsequently laughing at, but at the time they weren't.
So this is where nostalgia becomes part of reception history.
Yeah.
And, you have to understand how things are received. So the funniest film I have ever seen in my life was The Naked Gun 33 1/3. And the reason why it's the funniest film I've ever seen in my life was that I saw it at the Empire Leicester Square. And I was in a room of 4,000 people who were wetting themselves at every single line. And there's a great hysteria that builds up. And a great pleasure that comes up. You know, it's intensified by being in a room with people seeing it. It comes on TV and you think, why did I ever laugh at this? Or, you know, another example. The first time I ever saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show, I was 14 years old. We were on a choir tour from my secondary school to Berlin. And the people that I was staying with, who were 5 or 6 years older than me, decided that we'd go out to see a late night showing of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I had no idea what this was. But it was 1979, so the Rocky Horror Picture Show had been playing in Berlin for about 5 years or wherever it was it came out. And the audience participation had really grown and it developed. It had become sort of the ritual itself. And you put the young lad from Yorkshire into a cinema in Berlin where people are throwing rice and water everywhere around. And I had no idea what was going on. Yeah. Karaoke cinema. The other one, the example is When Harry Met Sally. If you've ever watched When Harry Met Sally, even you know, out of the cinema with somebody who really, really knows it, it's you're getting the dialogue half a second before it's actually spoken by Billy Crystal because there are so many good lines in it and you want to be part of it. Compare that with films which you're watching because you remember that there is a really good moment of dialogue and it doesn't happen because your memory of it is wrong. The famous example, you know, he never says play it again, yeah. Sam. You know, there are so many parts where the distillation of the memory, the distillation of the nostalgic engaged reception experience is different from the original. You know, what Humphrey Bogart should have said was, you know, what Martin Luther should have said was, what Abraham Lincoln should have said was. You know, William of Ockham never said anything that could be, you know, remotely as pithy as Ockham's razor. But, you know, the reception history requires us to distill it down into...
No, I had an interesting experience watching Tootsie at the BFI, a film I've seen many times over the years, only about 2-3 years ago. And what really struck me is that people were laughing at all the bits that I wouldn't have laughed at. So I know the film very well, some wonderful lines, but it was hilarious to see people laughing at the lines that were funny, but not laugh out loud funny. But the bits that I thought were laugh out loud funny were getting no more or no less sort of applause. Yeah. So it was me watching other people watching the film. So it was on those multiple levels. I suppose it's like going back in a diary and sort of like revisiting what you've already written or italicizing something because there's something more important when looked at from the vantage point of 10 or 20 years later, and you're almost like saying, well, this isn't part of the original version, but it has been imbued with extra layers of significance. So you're almost like critiquing or commenting on the original source material. And, and it was like that. And so I enjoy doing that. But sometimes, or a funny moment actually, was Basic Instinct when people were giggling at the bits that they shouldn't be giggling at, but just saying, you know, it was sort of... But I thought, well, I chose to see this in an auditorium. This was in the BFI once again. And I thought, I wouldn't, having watched it even since on my own at home, that those lines, you know, sort of didn't mean anything. But in a crowded audience, people were like, you know, this is really vulgar, this is really trashy. And they were going along with the spirit of it. And that has always and forever now will infect my understanding, for good or ill, of what that film
is
doing.
So this is the part of the problem is when the artists and the artifact lose control of the audience. And artists and artifacts, you know, they really want you to have a particular response. You know, Steven Spielberg is particularly bad at this. You know, Spielberg's cinema making, to a large extent, is very manipulative. And in his collaboration with John Williams, tells you exactly what feeling you're supposed to be feeling and how intensely you're supposed to be feeling it. But when they lose that control and the audience goes off in its own way, so I'll give you two examples. A long, long time ago, I saw the band Texas. Charlene Spiteri, they were playing at the Town and Country in Kentish Town, probably no longer there. And they were right at the height of their popularity and they'd had one hit, and I can't remember.
Oh, I Don't Want a Lover.
Thank you very much. they had that hit. And they were playing a sort of an extended 12-inch remix version. I hope you put a footnote in to explain what a 12-inch remix is for our younger listeners. Of that song, and it extended with a kind of 1-4-1-5-1-4 chord sequence, and the audience realised that this was the same chord sequence as U2's 40. So all of a sudden, the audience started singing, "How long to sing this song?" And a Texas gig started becoming a U2 gig. And you could see Texas getting really worked up because that was the wrong response. The other example was that when I was doing my O-levels, I was taken to go and see a school's matinee at the Theatre Royal in York of Romeo and Juliet. And 200 school kids all in uniform watching Romeo and Juliet. And the problem was is that you got to the end where Juliet is dead on a tombstone, and Romeo comes in and kills himself spoiler alert, kills himself. And the way that the director had done it was that Romeo collapsed over Juliet. And then Juliet comes too, and she's trapped under the dead weight of Romeo, and she can't move him because Romeo's dead. And alive, there's this actress going, "Romeo," she's shifting her shoulders and trying to wriggle out from underneath him. And of course, the bored school kids started laughing. And here's the most single tragic moment of Shakespeare's most tragic play, and it's hysterically funny. And the awful thing about it was the poor actors were then contracted to come back onto the stage at the end of it and do a question and answer session with all these kids who were studying Romeo and Juliet for O-level. And I can still remember the actor who played Romeo's face. He did not want to be there. But the artists had lost control of the emotional reaction of the audience. Now, when I think of Romeo and Juliet, it's a comedy. Because you know you've got the slapstick of Juliet being trapped by Romeo's body, which I'm sure is not Shakespeare's intention.
It's funny how in other contexts as well, thinking in a teaching context, I might use the same lecture notes or the same sort of basic residue each year, but I'm never delivering the same lecture because the reference points. Like actually, a good example was a couple of years ago. I was talking on biblical epics. Jesus biopics. None of the students had seen any of them. Maybe one or two of them had seen Life of Brian, but I thought I've got to do this for 2 hours. And I thought, well, they haven't seen any of the films. They're not really interested. So I stopped and I thought, how can I redo this? I've got 2 hours of this. And I thought, who's seen Bohemian Rhapsody? And suddenly they're all like, we saw it last night. This was October, November 2018. So they suddenly were all getting really excited. They're like, oh, he's talking about a film that we chose to see, and he's saying something that's connecting and resonating with us. So I found myself on the spot sort of thinking of the whole, because there were lots of debates about whether the story was hagiographic, the extent to which we were reading back into Freddie Mercury's life, or the other band members of Queen, because, of course, arguably they were making sure that they had, each one of them had something amazing to offer. It wasn't all down to Freddie. And how much of it was true or not, and the whole chronology of Live Aid and whether when he knew he had AIDS. But there were all these questions about accuracy and source material and authenticity, but also about somebody's death, premature death, leading to them, being given huge reverential treatment. And then I was reading each one of the biblical epics through the lens of Bohemian Rhapsody. I hadn't planned to do it, but it kind of weirdly worked because it was the same template about putting somebody on a pedestal, Jesus on a pedestal, Freddie Mercury on a pedestal. And it led to an interesting critical conversation. But I wasn't expecting that. But that was the great joy of actually almost like being freed from this, the sort of, we have to teach the curriculum, but the curriculum is only going to work if we do it in such a way that feels fresh and engages the audience. Otherwise, it's inert. I can easily read something out for 2 hours, but what would be the point? Nobody's really getting anything from that. And it was one of the, it has happened on other occasions, but suddenly you feel the room coming alive because you're connecting with the room, and it doesn't always happen. And it happens for the wrong reasons.
Well, this is the problem of film and theology. And film and theology operating within a canon. So, 25 years ago when film and theology exploded as a discipline, and there are so many books that are published all about how you read a film theologically, how you read theology using cinema. And I've even got a book of, actually three volumes, of how to preach the Revised Common Lectionary, 3-year cycle of Sunday readings with a particular movie for every Sunday of the year. The trouble is so many books came out at the same time. So many people discovered this as a fruitful at the same time, but they're all the same films. And when you think about, teaching today with millennials And everybody, you know, when you say millennials, you think 18-year-olds. But, you know, the oldest millennial is now 39. You know, yeah. millennials are in middle age. And yet, the films that I think of as really interesting and engaged and hip and happening expressions of particular theological ideas, they've never seen them. Yeah. Despite the long tail of Amazon Prime, other streaming services are available. They've never seen them because they've never known that they were significant. So, oh yes, this really reminds me of Babette's Feast. Mm. What? What's Babette's Feast? The other day, I mentioned to you, I saw The Player, Robert Altman, available on Amazon Prime. And I hadn't seen it since it came out in 1992. And there are two bits in it that where one of the antagonists goes to a art cinema to go and see The Bicycle Thieves. And everybody thinks, oh, yes, this is a completely normal thing in Hollywood. I'm thinking, when was the last time The Bicycle Thieves was available to view anytime, anywhere? And would people know that The Bicycle Thieves was an interesting film to go and see? Somebody puts a pitch to Tim Robbins, the music exec, the film exec character, and Tim Robbins says, oh, it's like The Gods Must Be Crazy, except the Coke bottle is a... I'm thinking, yeah, I remember seeing The Gods Must Be Crazy, and I thought that was a wonderful film. Is it available? How would you see that now? So the films which mark the canon for those of us of, you know, our age and vintage, the people who were exposed to film and theology as a burgeoning discipline, they've completely moved on. So, you know, how then do you make the connection, unless you start teaching that this is classic? And you have to understand that, you know, this is old and it's good for you and it's like eating oatmeal.
Sometimes in life, the things that really galvanise us and excite us are those in which we take a risk and think, oh, I didn't know I could do that. And the first time for everything, going to university, other people have done it before, but you haven't done it before. It's a big deal. But when you then, as I did, I stayed in the same place, I did all my degrees in one place, there's a point where you kind of feel, I'm kind of repeating myself a bit. It's going for the safety option. And the same with the religion and film field, that I kind of felt that I was doing something that felt pioneering at the time. But then, I fully admit, a few years ago, I was teaching my students, and maybe to an extent still do, and I'm still quoting Groundhog Day, The Shawshank Redemption, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the same sources that appeared in the 90s.
Films that are now 30 years old.
And then increasingly, the fewer students have seen them, hence I said about Bohemian Rhapsody. So I sometimes feel that the students are teaching me as much as I'm teaching the students. But you are right. But there is a point. Maybe I've moved on in my own research to an extent. I don't draw on film to the same degree for the simple reason that it kind of feels that I've said what needs to be said. You can always find new examples to make the case, but you can do it through different thematic operations.
So how much longer do you think you'd have to wait before one of your keen, bright, and enthusiastic students comes up to you and says, Professor Deasy, do you know that it's possible to say that there are some Jesus films and there are some films about Christ figures? And as if they've just discovered it for themselves. And you go, right, here we are, back in 1995. Yeah.
But there is something about the debate to be quite synthetic, because I will happily spend a couple of hours critiquing Christ figures, but I'm not aware that the problem of Christ figures is not a problem that the students in the class necessarily see, but I'm presenting it as something that was important to me 20 years ago when I started this, and I feel I should teach it because, in a sense, I've contributed to that, and it's sort of it is something that, at least historically now, is kind of a big deal. But it was a big deal 20 years ago. To what extent do I completely tear up the curriculum and do something new? Or do I say, well, it's like when somebody once said, well, all the Death of God theologians, maybe the one or two of them I teach are still alive, but really most of them are dead and have been dead a long time. There comes the point where you say, well, you know, you teach it because it's historically important. Or do you say, well, yeah, but you don't teach the same things, the same, and they're all male as well. Do you still draw on the same sources year in, year out? Or do you ever think, well, it's time to bring in some new figures, or, you know, but the students who you're teaching wouldn't have known, you know, it's almost like saying you need to know the basics. To do a course on religion and film, you need to know something about religion. So you're teaching, in inverted commas, the basics, and then you're letting the students go with it in the direction they choose to. But if you decide to do something completely different and off kilter, then you're not giving them the foundations in the subject.
So this is the interesting conversation then of, okay, you need to understand canon. You need to understand basic grammar in order to express yourself. You know, My argument is, yes, you can be as creative as you like, but you don't get your own grammar. Not if you want to actually talk to other people. And yes, there has to be a canon. And, you know, you supervising my PhD was the interesting question of how much can we assume is common knowledge? Or do we have to footnote everything? You know, this is a quotation from the Bible. The Bible is a collection of scriptures from Christian and Hebrew tradition. This is how the Bible was canonized. And, you know, going, you don't have to put that in a footnote for a PhD, which isn't about the development of the Bible. So there has to be a canon. There has to be an agreed basis of it. But then the question is, who gets to decide what's in the canon? Now, I don't think the hermeneutic of suspicion is very usefully applied to everything. You know, I don't think that when it comes to common knowledge that we should apply a Paxman's standards of why is this lying to me. But there is the question then of, okay, so, you know, we need to teach these theologians, we need to teach these ideas, we need to teach these experiences, we need to teach these cultural artifacts. Some of them have to be important. You know, it's important to talk about, it's important to talk about the Reformation if you want to understand present-day European culture. And perhaps, you know, the Reformation is perhaps maybe more important than talking about making as a mainstream compulsory course the history of astrology in the early modern period. You know, which is a more important way of understanding our society today, the Reformation or John Dee? You know, I tend to go for the 50,000-foot picture of the Reformation. But then we have to interrogate, you know, who is deciding upon that canon. And also, we have to interrogate the people who are critiquing it as well. I think it would be, that human tendency to make canon, we can see replicated popularly. I mean, how many different 1,000 movies to see before you die books, 1,000 books you must read before you die books, 1,000 places you must go before you die books. I mean, that's part of the process of categorizing human knowledge and experience. We can't experience everything. We don't have enough time, we don't have enough energy in order to experience everything that every human being has ever experienced ever, any time, anywhere. So we do say this is more important than that. But then again, you know, if it was a toss-up between watching some obscure experimental Czech film from the 1950s or Fred Astaire on a wet Saturday afternoon, I'm going to watch Fred Astaire, even though it might be the 50th time I've seen Top Hat.
And that's an interesting process as well, because I would, in my research, talk about the problem with escapism, and yet fully admit that often I would be excited by escapist films, and was I being hypocritical, or was I also saying that there? But you have to see something in order to pick up on its flaws, or to sort of know what the problem is. In order to know what the problem is with escapism, you need to know what escapism is, and then sometimes see it as maybe it's a holy spectacle, or maybe you find that it does something to you which you want to do something different with after the film. In other words, the whole Polanski thing over in Chinatown and the Robert Town, wasn't it? The tunnel at the end of the light at the end of the tunnel. Polanski changed the ending, and Polanski says that if the ending had been happy, people wouldn't be talking about it. They'd say, oh, what a relief, and they go home and make their cups of tea. But if there's a problematic noirish ending, people are more likely to come away and reflect and think and saying, why is the world as it is? So it's more what the film does to somebody. And so escapism can have its place, but it's what you do with it afterwards rather than letting the film do it all for you.
Now, I don't think escapism tends to be a boo word, and it tends to be a critical word applied by people wearing turtlenecks and stroking their chins. So in this respect, I'm very influenced by Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. And Tolkien's work on fairy tales talks about, you know, people say that fairy tales are escapist. But, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. If a man is in prison, it's his duty to escape. And when you're saying that a cultural artifact is escapist, what is the person escaping from? What are they escaping to? So I think that, you know, Tolkien's on fairy tales is a really good critique of this attitude that, it's escapist. Mm. You know, the pendant part of that is Richard Curtis's comment about how he's very often criticised as being unrealistic and feel-good and soggy and not really authentic. Mm. And you know, Curtis put the point really well. He said that you know, if he made a film in which a traumatized army veteran kills his pregnant girlfriend and then drags the baby out of her dead womb, people would hail him for being gritty and authentic. This is something that has never happened in the history of human existence, but because he makes a film about a boy falling in love with a girl, which happens every single day, people say that he's unrealistic. So there is this thing about you know, Polanski's thing about, you know, if you make it noir, if you make it dark, then it's going to be somehow truer to human experience. Mm. Well, no, it's basically we've forgotten the rule of man bites dog and dog bites man. You know, that we're depicting the things that are vanishingly rare. Mm. And like the fat boy in Pickwick Papers, you know, we're telling ourselves horror stories to make our own flesh creep, because then that confirms that we're alive. So I don't think escapism is necessarily a bad thing. It depends what we're escaping to. And one of my problems is the escapism that we have now is escapism into being consumers. You know, one of my critiques of the inundation of Marvel and superhero universes is that it's a consumer delivery mechanism. It's basically, we're making these incredibly expensive films so that you go out and buy the toys.
Yeah.
And that's George Lucas's fault, you know, because he perfected that in 1977. But a film is really the means by which we sell plastic.
Yeah, it puts me in a quandary this week with Christopher Nolan's film, which is meant to be saving cinema. But I'll go to the cinema and see anything. I'll happily travel the extra mile to see something that no one else is talking about, nobody else knows about, to see. I'm going to be seeing indeed later today. Looks like a good psychological thriller from Finland, I believe. And, you know, I'd never heard of it before I saw that it was shown
psychological
tonight.
Wouldn't it be great to go and see a happy-go-lucky musical from Finland?
Well,
they don't make those, do they?
Although there was, I think, with Bjork. Was that Finland, you know, Dancer in the Dark, which wasn't happy and escapist, but it was using the tropes of the musical to do that. But what is interesting is that when people are talking about the films that I must see, like when The Matrix or Star Wars, people say, oh, I bet you can't wait to see it. And I'm like, no, and there's part of me that's resisting that, as I did with Passion of the Christ, because I say, well, I see everything, and there are a lot of films that I will say, this is wonderful, you should go and see it. People don't, because they've never heard of it. But then the films that have all the excitement comes before the film, that it's the anticipation of the film, that suddenly that becomes the film to see. And you think, but what about all the films that really are worth seeing that we're not seeing because they haven't got the same hype or merchandising around? So I will go to the cinema most nights, go and see one of the Avengers Marvel films. I haven't seen all of the other ones in the sequence. It doesn't really do anything to me. People around there in costume and sort of really sort of imbibing that. And I'm thinking, I don't feel I belong here. And yet they probably wouldn't belong there any other night of the week when I'm at the cinema seeing my stuff. So there's a sense of we're seeing the films for different reasons. And I want to make the effort and see something that genuinely surprises me. I don't see it coming. Whereas in these films, as you say, they feel kind of very factory driven, very consumerist. They're very watching them. You kind of feel they're just merchandising products. Mm-hmm. And I even struggle to review them because I watch them. Sometimes I can happily sit there for 3 hours. I've got zero. The only thing, one of the Avengers films was when Robert Redford appeared for about a minute, and I had no idea what he was doing in there. But it was the most exciting bit of it because it seemed incongruous, and I thought, "Ooh, I didn't see that coming." And I thought, if the whole movie had been like that, then that would have been my kind of thing.
What Robert Redford was doing in that film was probably the story that Mark Kermode tells about Michael Caine and why Michael Caine made the decision to make some of the dodgy films he had.
Jaws 4, The Revenge.
Why did you make this film? I said, well, I opened up the script and it said The Bahamas Dawn. And I thought, yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah. Well, a few more as we start to wrap up, just in some more philosophically based questions. Mm. Would you say your memories are predominantly positive as you survey your life and career?
Positive? I don't know. That's an interesting question. I mean, I don't find myself crippled by thinking about the past, so I suppose that must mean that my memories are positive. I recognise that there have been times in my past where I have been deeply, desperately unhappy. And I can remember those instances, and I'm not sort of frightened off them or running away from them. I can remember huge conflicts with my father, especially when I was a teenager. And yet my relationship with my father before he died was comforting and friendly, not friendly, supportive, and you know, just really, really endearing. And I recognize his presence in my life today in a very, very positive way. I mean, as one gets older, I find myself, you know, the joke about, you know, that aging is part of the process of groaning when you stand up and then groaning when you sit down. And when I groan, when I sit down, I hear my father's voice. And that's the funny thing. And, you know, if you'd said to me when I was 12, when I was sort of butting heads with my father, that one day that would be a source of comfort to me, and I'd have been very surprised. I recognise in myself a lot of Welshness, and my father was Welsh. And, you know, C.S. Lewis said that the Welsh do not have a gift for happiness. And there is this kind of sensitivity to one's surroundings and one's history that I think is particularly Welsh, and the whole idea of hiraeth, and that kind of sort of overwhelming emotion that you get at the thought of a communal experience, which is why, you know, the Welsh are such great hymn singers at rugby matches. And I recognise that in myself as well, and that there isn't, I don't think, you know, the Welsh have a great gift for happiness. I think Lewis is right in that. But I'm okay with that. There is an element of, as one goes through life, one recognises that, you know, the great lie that we tell our children is, you can be anything that you want to be. Mm. It's just nonsense. You know, the sheer fact of wanting is not going to make me a fighter pilot. You know, my ambition for the whole of my life, before it became unrealistic, and subsequently since it's been completely unrealistic, is to be a fighter pilot in an English Electric Lightning. There isn't a single English Electric Lightning that still flies, and yet I still want to be a fighter pilot in English Electric Lightning. I'm never going to be. And I can remember when I was reading a book as an 8-year-old, and when the characters in the books realised that he was not going to be able to be a fighter pilot because he was wearing glasses, and I was reading this book wearing my glasses, and the devastation I felt that I was never going to be a fighter pilot because of that. But, you know, the I've always said that this is a quote from E.M. Forster, because my chaplain at university said that it was a quote from E.M. Forster, and I don't think it is. I've been trying to track it down. But, you know, E.M. Forster didn't say, Humphrey Bogart didn't say, that the reason why young people find the ending of their first love affair so devastating is they have no experience of disaster survived. And the great advantage of being 55, as I am now, is that I have had lots of experience of lots of disasters survived. Quite a few of them my direct responsibility. And being able to get to the other side of it and being able to recognise, okay, this is what's happened to me, and this is what is likely to happen to me in the future, but I remain not because of any, you know, great gift of my own or any great moral standing of my own, but because of I am part of and engaged with others, and not least of which is, you know, from my Christian faith, engaged with the community of saints, recognizing that the individual things that happen to one in life, that is not the totality of who one is. And it's interesting that I started using the word one rather than I. My memories are mostly harmless, I guess.
But because I think, I mean, concomitant with that, I guess, is the whole question of being nostalgic about negative experiences. Because I'm trying to wrestle with this idea that, are we always perhaps trying to reframe the past? You've touched on some of this already, in the light of, you know, contemporary mores. You know, it's Robin Hood as seen through the lens of the 20th century rather than in 8 centuries ago, whatever it might be. But I find it really interesting that sometimes there's this recalibration going on, that something happens, it's not good, maybe we're in a very dark period of our lives, but somehow the fact that we've survived it, we've turned it around, means that we then see that as a benchmark. Like, well, I survived it, therefore what else can I survive? I did that, so there's a template. But if you knew before it happened, like you mentioned about love when you were a young person, you've never had sort of, you know, you've never had a bad relationship or you've never suffered terribly, it might then be that the idea of suffering is appalling. But once you've been through it, you can say, well, I've learned something from that, and maybe there are things not to do the next time around. And I wonder if there's, we're doing this all the time, we're constantly renegotiating, we're always sometimes successfully learning, sometimes actually not learning from what we've done, the good things and the bad things, and we're destined to play out the same mistakes forever. Or there's a point sometimes when we say, well, this was the template, this is how I did it. I mean, university, good example. This is a more superficial example, but you sometimes think, I can't possibly get this dissertation done by the deadline, I can't possibly write these exams, I don't feel I'm prepared. But you do it, you do quite well, and you think, oh, it wasn't so bad after all. And suddenly everything after that point just becomes a little bit more manageable. Do you ever have those kind of experiences?
One of the go-to anecdotes that I have is Norman Parkinson taking a photograph of the Queen Mother for one of her official birthdays and in advanced old age. I can't remember which one it was. And he took this photograph of her and very gently suggested to her that he might use some touching up, pre-Photoshopping days, but touching up the photograph. And she said, oh no, Mr. Parkinson, I'd hate to think that I had lived so many years and had nothing to show for it. And this idea that, you know, the wrinkles of an old lady is the mark of having survived those things. I think that you know, there are some people, and I see it in my job, you know, dealing with people who live with the most appalling psychological and physical abuse, and the most and the largest self-imposed burden of psychological and physical abuse, for which the encouragement to buck up, Dorcas, there are plenty, you know, worse things happening at sea, and you know, just get out there and enjoy life, is entirely the wrong thing to say and to do. And one of the best images that I've ever come across about the reason why we pray for people is that, like the image of the paralytic who comes in through the roof to be healed by Jesus. Our focus tends to be on Jesus, our focus tends to be on the paralytic. We tend to forget about the paralytic's friends who break open the roof and lower him through the roof to lay him before Jesus. And the best example, an image of prayer, is laying the people in need of healing of whatever kind before God, and being, you know, responsible for that conscious laying before God of that. And quite often, the only thing that you can do with people who have suffered and continue to suffer and will always suffer great psychological, mental, spiritual pain is, you know, just to be with them in that way, and to realise that because that they are suffering, that they are not abhorrent, that they're not excluded from humanity. However, at the same time, there is a tendency in our society at the moment, because we live such comfortable lives compared with the vast majority of humanity alive today, let alone the vast majority of humanity in the past. I mean, we live in a world in which there is anesthetic for dentistry. If you want to go live back in the past, think about root canal without anesthetic. So, you know, just
unless you're Gordon Brown about to deliver his budget, of course, in which case he's like, I can't do that. I need to be able to speak.
We live in the single most comfortable civilization that has ever existed. I know that there are people who don't experience that even in our own country. But because of that, we tend to focus upon our status as victims. We tend to focus upon our, you know, there's this sort of weird inverted hierarchy of the more oppressed we are, then the better. And I can remember hearing a conversation on Radio 4, there you go, that talks about my status in society, of almost 30 years ago, of a woman who was saying that because she was posh and went to a private school, people were prejudiced against her, and she wanted to organise a society for the protection of posh people. And I'm thinking, well, here's an interesting thing. If somebody in the top, whatever percentage, socioeconomic categories of our society recognises that to have a moral standing in society, you now have to present yourself as a victim. And so my antidote to this constantly is the experience of Guy Gibson, who was, in the spring of 1943, having survived 50 bombing operations over Germany, was told that rather than being put on to rest and recuperation, he was going to be responsible for recruiting, equipping, training a brand new squadron that was going to have a brand new a mission, secret mission, which is going to help change the course of the war, and did so from February to May 1943. The squadron was 617 Squadron, the Dambusters, and they developed this secret weapon with Barnes-Wallace, and they dropped the bombs on the German dams, and I can't remember the exact number, but 56 out of 95 aircrew, pilots and aircrew, were lost that night. And when Gibson, by his actions, he'd flown over the dams, dropped his bomb, and then flew interference to draw away the flak fire from the German anti-aircraft fire, four or five times, landed at Scampton, and before he went off to breakfast, sat down and wrote a letter to the families of the 56 men who were killed, and Gibson was just 24 years old. And, you know, we're in a society now where people don't actually reach maturity until their 40s, if ever. You know, he's not yet grown up enough, he's not yet mature enough, and yet Gibson was doing this at age 24. And I know that he was doing it at the age of 24 during a total war. And it's not a good idea to organise total war in order to get our young men to grow up. But there is this element of really the best way to be a human being, the best way to be a flourishing human being, is to recognise your responsibility to others. And rather than thinking that introspection or solipsism is the only way to go, you know, somebody once said, the best way to find your life is to lose it. And that's a profoundly countercultural thing. I mean, when was the last time you saw a film in which somebody found their life by losing it, other than sort of, you know, in war hero tropes? I mean, Saving Private Ryan is an example of it. Of Gods and Men is another example of it. This idea of the noble sacrifice is one thing, but the anonymous sacrifice... and I think that that's one of the things in which is the challenge for our society, is how we actually modulate, resist the increasing drive to becoming individual consumers rather than members of one another. You know, how do we? And I think that, you know, COVID has really set a challenge of that. You know, where you and I were talking about it today, I wear a mask to protect you. You wear a mask to protect me. What do you do about the bugger who's not going to wear a mask at all? And, you know, the expressions of our concern and our engagement one with another is really challenged by this idea that we are just atomized individuals who are spending our money to keep the multinational corporations going.
And you just made me think when you refer to the anonymous sacrifice, even in a film that is literally life or death, like Flatliners, it's about short-circuiting karma, having your afterlife now so you can come back and grow. Don't wait till you die to learn the lesson. Do it now while you're still young and still a medical student. So it's that sense of having it now, the sense that you don't die anonymously. You have to live. You have to survive. Death is almost like, in the case of Flatliners, death is a conduit. It's a pathway. It's a rite of passage towards a new reinvigorated selfless life, or is it on Earth?
Well, you see, now Flatliners is one of the few films I've ever walked out of,
and
despite it having Julia Roberts in. And one of the reasons why I'm talked out of it is that I think it's profoundly meretricious, and it's the idea that one can manipulate death. You know, the one thing that we cannot manipulate, you know, we are all going to die, and that is the one thing that we can say that is definite, and yet. You know, a major Hollywood industrial complex can make a film which says, yes, there is a way of actually getting out of the consequences of death. You know, and it's not a new idea. I mean, Christopher Marlowe was dealing with Faustus. So, you know, and you see what happens to him. Or even before, you know, look at Dante. I mean, look at all those people who thought that they could manipulate their way out of death and their experiences in the afterlife as well. So, you know, if you're rich enough, you can buy your way out, or you can manipulate your way out, or you can use technology to cyborg your way out of the experience. You know, the whole idea that we're going to reach the singularity during our lifetime, and that people will then be able to upload their consciousness and their identity to replicant bodies. It's a profoundly anti-human and a profoundly totalitarian view.
Yeah. In terms of where you are now in your life, I mean,
Chingford.
E4. Would you say, I was even to this day, it shows my age, I still think of Norman Tebbit, and was it Ian Duncan Smith?
He's the MP here.
But would you say you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young? I mean, do you entertain...
I'm not a fighter pilot in a lightning crisp.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Actually, it's funny, my last interview with wanted to be a fighter pilot.
There you go, it's a trait.
But isn't that interesting that, you know, that whole sense of, you know, your 5 or 15... What would you say now to your 5 or 15-year-old self? What would your 5 or 15-year-old self say to you now if they'd known what you would turn out to be, not just in Chingford, all these decades later?
So, you know, my undergraduate was at the LSE. In the 80s, it was at the time of the Big Bang, which was a huge thing then, and now is part of ancient history, the deregulation of the financial markets. And so many of my contemporaries went into finance. And about 10 years ago, I had an anniversary, a reunion, which I only went to for the LSE. I feel very little sympathy or connection with the LSE. I only ever mention it as a way of boasting. Me, Mick Jagger, John F. Kennedy, and Jed Bartlett, the four most famous graduates of the LSE. But I went to the reunion mostly because the dinner was going to be in the members' dining room of the House of Commons, because the editor of the student newspaper, for which I was the photographic editor, is now a Tory MP in Norfolk. And so we were hosted there. And because I was a clergy person, they put me on the top table to say grace. And I looked around and I could see lots of people that I recognised, including somebody who was then in the cabinet and who was my exact contemporary at the LSE and who I had no recollection of at all at the LSE. And I looked at all these people and I recognised them from the Thursday lunchtime union meeting, which was very, very popular, very rowdy. Every Thursday there was a students' union meeting. And there were members of the Federation of Conservative Students, and there was members of the Socialist Workers' Student Society, and there was member of Labour students, and the Liberals, and Trotskyists, and there was even one person who was in the 80s was holding up a candle for Enver Hoxha in Albania. And there they all were sitting at the same table, and they were all now working either in the media or in the city. Wealth management or various things. And they all lived in Muswell Hill or Primrose Hill, and they all knew each other, and they were all best mates, even though they'd been terrible enemies politically 30 years before. And I thought to myself, and I thought, where did it all go right? You know, I could have so easily ended up in that world, thinking that because I was earning my age in thousands of pounds by the time I graduated, that somehow I was, you know, morally affirmed by the universe. And thinking, okay, so there's so-and-so, who's the director of Barclays Wealth. I've taken 600 funerals, and including a funeral last week of a 20-year-old girl who died of an operation that went wrong to remove a tumour from her spine, and it was just heartbreaking. And I hadn't, you know, other than being a fighter pilot, I had no idea really what I wanted to be when I was 15. And I'm actually really, really glad that I'm in the position where, you know, when I come to die, I will be able to say, at least in one of those 600 funerals, I might have made a difference. I might have comforted somebody. I might have given some people, in the face of the grave and in the face of death, I gave people some hope and showed them a way in which it was possible to live a life that was flourishing even in the midst of death. And being able to do that once justifies my existence. So, you know, my son is living the life of a rock star, which is, you know, I wanted to be a musician at one point, who didn't start a band. You know, and he's actually doing that, and his first album's out now, and it's wonderful, and he's so much more musically skillful than I am, and I'm really glad that he's doing it, and I'm really glad that it's not me. I don't have that kind of, I might be nostalgic for the things that didn't happen, but I'm not envious for the things that happened to other people.
It is funny with one's own children sometimes. There is that sense that they may actually do the very things just because naturally they're going to do it that you've spent your life agonising over. You know, if one of my children ended up going and doing something in broadcasting, it would almost feel like, well, that's what I wanted to do. But somehow you kind of feel that maybe it wasn't right for me in the right time, the right place. But your children kind of fulfil a certain destiny almost, which you know, you feel, well, actually, they're doing it, and actually, it's exactly what you're so proud of, and you want them to succeed in that. But so, you thought it could easily have been you.
Well, you see, I mean, I'd like to resist the idea of genetic determinism. I mean, because, you know, I don't want to be sort of young Frankenstein. Destiny, no escaping destiny. And you know, particularly, you know, I can see it over and over again of people who are living their lives through their children. You know, the whole sort of beauty pageant industry as well, you know, that kind of thing. You know, you let your kids do your own thing rather than actually experiencing life through their eyes. I mean, virtual reality, I think, is pretty limiting. As an entertainment format, but it's awful when the mechanism for virtual reality is your own children's lives as well. I don't want to live the life of a rock star through my son. Let him live his own life.
And I think sometimes people will find their own way forward, and it's very interesting. The number of people I know who have become priests, for example. And there's a priest in the family, or teachers, there's a teacher in the family, and they resist it. And they don't want to be their parents, but they end up becoming their parents. And in many cases, in much later life, it's you know, maybe when they become middle-aged themselves, they start to live out something which they resisted for the decades before it, but then realise that is, I shouldn't use the word destiny, but almost...
Or
the sister, infamy, they're all going to infamy. But my very last question... Justin, would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Again, the law of the excluded middle. Can one say both?
You can, please. Well,
okay, I'm a historian.
Well, listen to William Rowlandson's interview, and he spoke. I say it's my last question. Half an hour later, he said, "What a ridiculous question! You know, why do you have to come up with these binaries?" And he said, "Look at Brexit."
That doesn't sound like William Rowlandson at all. I'm a historian, and so. I don't think that we can have any sense of where we are now if we don't have an understanding of where we've been. And one of the great, I think one of the great advantages to my ministry as a priest is having begun as a historian. So particularly when I was doing scriptural studies, and all these theologians who were studying scriptural studies and never studied history properly, so therefore didn't know what a historical fact was if it hit them over the head. And because of that, made everything so much more contingent than necessarily had to be. I think that, you know, the idea that we've been here before, we've been in this similar situation before, is really, really useful to moderate hysteria. There was a stage 10 years ago when Ruth Gladhill was still writing for the Times, where every week she'd write that the Church of England is facing the greatest crisis since the Reformation because of... And I was thinking, what, worse than the English Civil War, when the Church of England was abolished and the Presbyterian establishment was put in its place? Is this worse than that? Being able to have that kind of degree of scepticism that comes as a historian, which means then I'm constantly looking backwards. I'm constantly, making the connections and with the past. Looking forward, I think, is a different thing, because I think that there tend to be two ways of people have of looking forward. One is, it's going to be disastrous, it's going to be awful, I'm just going to spend my life worrying about all the things that could happen 20 or 30 years down the line. And I'm going to be 40 someday. In 8 years' time, when Harry met Sally. You know, what's the point of, if you're 32, worrying about being 40 someday? leave tomorrow for tomorrow. It has plenty of worries for itself, someone once said. So there's that. But then there's also the problem of building castles in Spain, of you know, placing all one's living in the future. If I can only get into this particular position, then I will be happy, which is a variation of the traveller's fallacy. It's the time traveller's fallacy. If, you know, I'm unhappy here and now, if I'm there and then, I will be happy. And I keep on thinking of Jimi Hendrix's song, Castles Made of Sand, which is just this cruel, cruel little song about, you know, three or four vignettes of stories of people who were hoping for good things to happen, and then that goodness was just snuffed out. Mm. And so we're like castles made of sand, our dreams fall into the sea eventually. So there's that about, okay, there's not much point in worrying about the future. It's going to happen. And all the different possibilities, you know, wargaming, all the different possibilities that could happen in order for you to get somewhere. You know, Woody Allen, whom we're not allowed to quote anymore, once said, don't tell God your plans if you don't like laughter. And I think that's true. You know, try to live in the moment, which is a stupid thing to say, but you know, try to live in as much as one can peaceably. Make sure that one is responsible, that you know, the things that you have to do, the things that other people are relying you on to do, do them. You know, try to make the world and your immediate surroundings a little bit better than it is. And this is, you know, something as trivial as if you see rubbish in the street, pick it up. You know, don't contribute to the work of Greenpeace, but you know, trash your local environment. Don't support the work of Oxfam, but be beastly to people around you. Don't do that. Live peaceably with all. Paul says. And then, you know, recognize that whatever you think is going to happen to you, more than likely won't, but whatever does happen to you can in itself be blessing. I'm not going to be a fighter pilot, but I'm okay with that.
On that cerebral and tantalizing note, Justin, thank you for being my guest this week.
Thank you very much, Chris.